Ehrlichman, Robinson, and Young.
And if you did have occasion to transmit to the chairman some of the content of that additional material,
Tape 4, Ehrlichman, Robinson, and Young.
Now, the only remaining question is how. And if you did have occasion to transmit to the chairman total material for use of that additional material, now, the only remaining question is how Radford happened to produce that total material for your assistant. Did you do that at your instance?
No, I never asked for anything. I simply was started to resurrect from this mishmash of paper that came back that which I thought should get back to Al and that which should stay in my office. And
did you initiate that process?
Well, the briefcases would all come back at one time, and
all right, but why did they come to your office rather than to Al's office?
Well, I don't know.
Did you cause that to be done, or did Radford?
Oh, I didn't care where he brought them. All I know is that when I would come into work, why, there would be all the briefcases.
Did Al subsequently brief you, Robbie, on the particular aspect in which you had given him the books and set up the questions? I mean,
yeah. Sure. Al did brief me on the trips, and during his absence, messages would come in, and these messages would be shown to me insofar as I needed to get information ready for Dr. Kissinger prior to Al's return.
So basically all you had sent out on a trip were the two books. I mean, I can see it coming back as a mishmash. The problem I have is with the quantity. I would think that, you know, by and large, all the stuff was out. You had given Al the book. Al had taken it out to use to ask his questions and his points, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And when it came back, I mean, it was still all his, technically. It was still his, which you had given it to use, and he had used out there, and he had come back with it.
No, I don't remember the modalities of how we decided to sort the thing out. I mean, did you talk to Al about the sorting process? Well, I don't know whether I couldn't say yes or no. I mean, I think it is important, Mr. Ehrlichman, to recognize one thing, that during this entire period of time, I considered myself a member of the NSC staff, and really at Al's personal office, in helping him get ready for the trip, helping him get the trip debriefed, and doing whatever I could to better serve my two principals, Dr. Kissinger and
but do you see the gravamen of my question?
Yes,
and it goes to the fact that the chairman and the joint chief is only one of the NSC's clients, so to speak,
right.
And that there's the CIA and state and DIA and a number of other agencies, and that not everything goes to all of them.
That's correct.
And that, furthermore, there would appear to be, as suggested by the testimony we've taken so far, there would appear to be a conscious effort on the part of the chairman, acting through pages, to develop information beyond the scope of that which ordinarily would have been distributed.
Well, I think that's something only he could answer. The establishment of the liaison book was overt in the telephone book, and for the design purpose of helping the chairman better serve the president and Dr. Kissinger.
But not without limitation. You knew of that, would you not?
Well, there were no terms of reference there.
Well,
I mean, the reference,
for instance, would be that if the liaison officer were not on a distribution, that becomes a term of reference, does it not?
No, I wouldn't think so, because we didn't have. I mean, I oftentimes would not be on the distribution, but I would be called upon to work in areas in which I would be expected to make a contribution to Al or to Dr. Kissinger or to the chairman.
So that your function included perhaps reference to documents as to which you would not be normally on distribution.
Absolutely. And I mean, and that's why it's difficult for me to say that on any particular document I saw it with authority or not.
Well, let me suggest a very extreme hypothetical case. Let us assume that Henry wrote out longhand the memorandum to the president. And it was deposited in the future and had an opportunity to hand it to the president.
Right.
I say that would clearly be beyond the scope of your
Thank you.
got to this war or not. But, for example, Crocker would be prepared for a 2 o'clock meeting at 1:15, as you know.
I will. Let me cut you short on that and go to your question about the melodrama. There isn't any question but what his testimony is corroborated by Admiral Wallander, insofar as Admiral Wallander's term of office is concerned. So that I don't think that we can take his admission.
I don't know. Let me say, Admiral Wallander has not told me whether he did or not. But the melodrama that I wanted to mention, if I may just take a minute here. West Side meeting, let's say, would start at 2 o'clock, and the papers wouldn't be finished until 1 or 1:15. I would get Dick Kennedy's book. I'd say, I got to have the book. I have 30 minutes to get to the chairman. There are 15 questions. He'll say, here it is. I would rush in out of bed and say to the yeoman, Bradford, Xerox this right away. Now, with an order such as that carries a certain surreptitiousness to it, which was not intended. And he would go rushing down the hall to get it. I would also caution him, do not show these documents to anyone else. In other words, I would deliver the talker to the chairman. When the chairman was finished with the talker, it would come back to me, and I caution Radford, do not show anyone this talker. This was the limited distribution over on the other side, and so either the chairman at the end of the meeting would hand me the book, or he would bring it back, and they would buzz, Radford would go and get it. So Radford was A, caution never to show the talker to anyone, which would lead him to, I think, view the operation much more clandestinely than I had intended. And when I would get talker from, I can't remember even the names of some of the staff officers, but Hal Saunders. I would work with the staff officers over here preparing the talker. And then they would call me and they'd say on the phone, talker's ready. So I would say to Radford, go down to so-and-so's office and get the talker for the WESAG meeting and Xerox the copy real fast and put the original back on his desk because he needs it. All I'm saying is that in Radford's inner life, this could have clandestine connotations far beyond that which we're discussing.
But knowing his inner life, do you think he could confuse that sort of a procedure with going into somebody's briefcase and taking out a document and Xeroxing it and then putting the document back without the owner's knowledge?
Well, all I can say is that I don't have any knowledge of that.
No, I'm asking you whether you think his intellect would discriminate between those two kinds of events.
It might not. It might not. Because I kept that tremendous pressure on him, impressing him with the severity of holding this information close, that every document carried with it that connotation. If it was just an NSSN calling for a study that I wanted to get a copy of to start work on, I would impress upon him how important it was to A, hold it close, B, make no distribution of it, and so forth. So I could have contributed to almost a paranoid attitude on the part of Radford with respect to these papers.
Well, let me suggest that rather than a paranoid attitude, he may have had a kind of a team spirit about securing things out of the ordinary kinds of documents for the use of you or your principal, which otherwise might not have come to your notice. Did you ever detect any such attitude on his part?
I'm not sure I understand.
Did you ever admonish him to keep his eyes and ears open for the good of the order, for the good of the office, for the good of the
any information that I needed, I got directly from the staff office or from Dr. Shipping or direct order from the I would move his eyes and ears, sir. Any information that I needed, I got directly from the staff office or from Dr. Shipping or direct or from the general head.
this over and give it to the chairman.
He should see it. And that was about, as you said, about 20% of the total NSU output.
I guess that was a shot in the dark, but...
So let's focus on the other 80%. Was he ever encouraged to keep his eyes and ears open?
Not by me, sir. Not by me, because I operated it strictly on the basis of telling him what I wanted him to Xerox, telling him I wanted him to hold them closed, and so forth.
How long have you known Admiral Wallander?
Not well. I've known him by reputation. I suggest on a casual basis for several years.
Did you have anything to do with his selection as your successor?
No, Admiral Moore selected me.
Did you, were you consulted?
Yes, I was consulted.
Did you recommend him?
I didn't recommend him because no one recommended anyone to the chairman. He said, Admiral Wallander will be your relief.
He had made up his mind before he consulted you.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I told Admiral Moore that I felt that I should go to sea after having stayed the 10 months or 8 months for the turnover period. I thought that I should go to sea in order to come back with my contemporaries and command FC. And he said, I think I had a couple recommendations of people I thought would do good jobs. I can't even remember who they were now. He said, no, I think the person that I think would be the best in that job would be Admiral Wallander. He worked for me before, and he's completely trustworthy and so forth.
And did you concur or dissent or express no opinion or what?
Well, I concur because, I mean, he has a moral assertive reputation.
Knowing his reputation and knowing what you do about Radford, the impression that you have of Radford, do you have any explanation for why Radford would institute a course of conduct under Admiral Wallander, where he went into the papers of other people and brought them surreptitiously to the Admiral for transmission to the chairman?
No, I have no explanation of that.
One thing I wanted to be clear with, obviously, you are not enthusiastic about losing your one guy that was going to help you for the week or 2 weeks you'll have the longer on the trip. So what did you do during that time? Did you get relief from the Pentagon, from the pool of some sort?
I would go to the chairman, but in the absence of Al, my job sort of went
for you to go ahead and volunteer and let Radford go.
When Al asked me to find a military room, I can think of three that I tried to get rather than relinquish my yeoman. And I think I had the same institutional selfishness that anyone has in losing a stenographer. And I tried to get the chairman's yeoman, I tried to get the director of the joint staff yeoman, I tried to get a reliable yeoman from the Navy, and everyone got my independence. So I finally came to Al and I said, I can only get the chairman's yeoman. Suggest one person. I hate to lose them, yeoman. I need him. But after all, he is a member of the NSC family, and it might be better for you to take him. I also suggested Radford because we had by that time received authorization for Radford to wear civilian clothes, and I thought that it would look better for Radford to go in civilian clothes than to go in uniform. Now, the one other thing that influenced me, Mr. Edmund, was that Radford was well received by the other people in the NSC staff. They simply liked him. There wasn't any animosity between military civilian or anything like that. Radford, for all intents and purposes, was a civilian. He wore civilian clothes. And many people expressed surprise that he wasn't a civilian employee. Now,
but there was no real advantage to you to let him go. I mean, it was all in the negative side.
No, I think quite to the contrary. I think it was the advantage of the system to let him go. I thought it would provide Al necessary clerical help, reliable clerical help. I mean, I certainly hope you're not implying that I sent him for my own personal gain. I didn't. It was at a loss to me, but it was an acceptable loss, and it was one that I was willing to make a sacrifice on for the good of General Hay.